Welcome to Tech Policy Podcast. I'm your host, Ashkan Kazarian. Today, I'm very excited to release our special International Women's Day episode. This conversation about women in STEM, in policy, in DC, in America, in the world, continues. It is crucial to know more about everyday heroes, smart and persistent women that passionately work to make the world a better place. So after podcasts, I started asking my guests about their career paths, what made them choose this life, and what drives them. This is the first of many episodes that shares amazing stories and I hope inspires you. It's my honor to host Gigi Zahn. She's a former president and co-founder of a prominent think tank, Public Knowledge. She was a counselor to the FCC Chairman Wheeler and is now a distinguished fellow at Georgetown Law at their Institute for Technology Law and Policy, and also is a Mozilla Policy Fellow. So Gigi, you are one of the first women in tech policy that I've heard of and read about, and you are a very prominent figure in the DC world. People are very passionate to debate you, to agree with you, to follow you. How did you end up doing what you're doing and found your passion in this field?
So I studied broadcasting and film as an undergraduate at Boston University. The internet wasn't a thing then. I mean, it was, you know, a thing in universities. So what you studied at the time was TV, radio, cable. And I started to get interested, after deciding I was not going to be a professional sportscaster, in the policy and the law surrounding television and radio and cable. So it was media largely. And that's what sent me to law school. Now, out of law school, the job opportunities were not particularly attractive for a communications lawyer. So I went into a law firm that did aviation law, of all things. I actually enjoyed it, but it really wasn't my passion. It's not what I wanted to do. And I started looking for a job about 2 years out of law school. And a gentleman named Andy Schwartzman, who ran an organization called the Media Access Project, which did litigation at the FCC and the federal courts, said, well, you've been doing administrative law, albeit through aviation. We do administrative law. Would you like to do communications administrative law? And I said, hell yeah. And it was one of the few places where you could actually be a public interest advocate and work in the communications field. I mean, the field of communications advocacy really only started in the early 70s after a court case where the D.C. Circuit said that individuals, private individuals, have standing to bring suits against the FCC if they didn't like the way they licensed broadcast stations and that sort of thing. So, you know, this was in the late 80s. I got an opportunity with the Media Access Project, and I started litigating cases at the FCC, filing comments, working on the Hill, and actually arguing cases in the D.C. Circuit, in the Ninth Circuit, in the Eighth Circuit. And that was sort of the beginning. Then I got a terrific opportunity in 1999 to go to the Ford Foundation and start what is now the biggest funder of public interest organizations like Public Knowledge, which is an organization that I ran for 12 years. So I went there. I successfully convinced the foundation to start this program. And then from there, I founded Public Knowledge with literally a handful of dollars and an office on top of Teaism in DuPont Circle. So I was at Public Knowledge for 12 years. And then Tom Wheeler, who had been nominated but not yet confirmed to be chairman of the FCC, calls me up one day. It was right before I was going to go to the Aspen Institute for a conference. And he said, Gigi, I've got this crazy idea. And I kind of knew what he was going to say, but he said, anyway, he said, I want to build coalitions for the kind of things I want to do, and I want you to build them for me. So I thought about it for about 36 hours, and I said, yeah, hell yeah. And it was a great experience. It was very different being in government as opposed to being in an NGO and saying essentially whatever I wanted to say. To kind of be in the bureaucracy is very, very different. But I really did love it, and it was great having a boss that wanted to do really great things.
So what's next for you? What's the next chapter?
So I left the FCC at the end of 2016. And fortunately, I was able to secure three fellowships The first was the inaugural class of the Leadership and Government Fellowship at the Open Society Foundations. That one actually has just expired just last week. I got another fellowship at Georgetown. So I'm housed at the Georgetown Institute for Technology, Law, and Policy, which is a new organization. I think it's only a couple of years old now, that houses a number of different think tanks and research organizations. And then I was lucky to be part of the class of the inaugural group of technology policy fellows from the Mozilla Foundation. So I've been very lucky to be supported by the foundation world. I'm doing a lot of writing, a lot of speaking, a lot of media. I'm doing a lot of coalition building with companies. I'm doing a lot of strategic advising of the field. You know, there was a time where I was the young Turk and on, you know, people's 40 under 40 list. Well, I'm no longer qualified for those lists. So I'm kind of more the eminence. I'm becoming one of the eminence greases of the communications bar, which is in some ways kind of scary. But I'm hoping at least for the next, you know, couple of years, I continue to do what I'm doing as sort of a professional fellow.
You have always been perceived, at least by people I've talked to and in my, you know, in my head, as this great cardinal of the tech policy in D.C. What would you say about, you know, this world in the sense of how diverse it is and how many women and minorities it has? Do you think it's getting better? And obviously, you've been in this field for a while. You've hired a lot of people. You've worked with everyone on the spectrum.
So when I was at Public Knowledge, we put a premium on hiring women and people of color. And I really sort of felt like Public Knowledge was a real launching pad for folks like that. Folks like Clarissa Ramon, who's, you know, working for Google Fiber in San Antonio, or Bartiz Cox, who, you know, worked in the press office of the FCC for a while, now actually is finding great success as a professional musician. Chris Lewis, who's still at Public Knowledge, who is, you know, their lead lobbyist, and terrific, a guy named Ernesto Falcone, who's now at the Electronic Frontier Foundation doing their legislative work. So that was always really, really important to Public Knowledge. Be that as it may, I still think that the field, and not just the public interest community, the public interest community is probably the shining star for diversity, but the field
is still bad.
It's still
just
bad.
FYI, it's a shining star, but it's still bad.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah. No, but the communications field itself, I'm sometimes embarrassed to be in meetings and summits. So I'll give you an example. So yesterday I went to a wonderful celebration of the 20th anniversary of the E-Rate Universal Service Program, which gives money, subsidies for broadband for schools and libraries. And I looked around the room, you know, at the summit, and then actually the reception, there was probably 150 people. I maybe saw a half a dozen people of color. It's awful. And part of it, I think, is a pipeline problem. And I am proud to say that my Mozilla Fellowship colleague, Alan Davidson, is working on a project where he is working with some historically black colleges and universities and community colleges to try to diversify the pipeline for technology policy and communications policy. Yes, we have. I should be saying this after being in the field for 30 years, but we have a really, really long way to go. And there are some fantastic women in the field. I work very closely with Sarah Morris from the Open Technology Institute, with Malkia Cyril from the Center for Media Justice. You know, Free Press has, you know, Candace Clement and Dana Floberg and Sandy Fulton. So there are some folks, that particularly young women, coming up, and I hope they see me as a mentor. But we still have a really, really long way to go, unfortunately, particularly as, you know, the head of organizations. We have Nuala O'Connor at CDT, and that's great, but that's about it. You know, all the other main public interest groups in D.C. anyway are headed by white men, and they're great people, but it doesn't meet the diversity standard by any means. And also, look, if you look at the heads of the tech offices here, the lobbying offices, both the tech offices and also the ISP offices and the trade associations, with the exception of Meredith Baker, and I guess now Margaret McCarthy is the head of Mobile Future, it's all guys, right? And with the exception of Dean Garfield, it's all white guys. So our field, you know, I obviously care deeply about the public interest community, but I do care about the field generally. We have a really, really, really long way to go. And I'll tell you from personal experience, the way it changes is if the person at the top decides that it's time to change. So I hate to pat myself on the back a little bit, but I feel like, you know, I started a tradition of public knowledge, which my successor, Jean Kimmelman, is continuing of bringing in people of color, women. But, you know, the big problem, particularly in the public interest community, and I don't think it matters, you know, what side you're on, is there's kind of a ceiling. And it's not just for women, right? It's this kind of... it's not a glass ceiling, but it's like the management ceiling. So, for example, not everybody can run an organization, and not every policy expert should run an organization. It's not the same skill set. I mean, I was very fortunate to get a lot of management training and communications training and media training. So even though I'm a lawyer by, you know, by trade, I haven't actually practiced law in about 20 years. It's been a long time. So I learned how to manage people. But not everybody who, you know, can cite chapter and verse of, you know, the Communications Act or Section 230 or the Communications Decency Act knows how to manage people. So how do we make sure that, you know, people in their late 30s and early 40s stay in the public interest community? What can we give them to do where they feel fulfilled and feel like they're actually moving up? And I think it's a major challenge.
But it's about time that we talk about it.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for being the trailblazer, and it was a pleasure having you on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Michelle Richardson is a Deputy Director for Freedom, Security, and Technology Project at the Center for Democracy and Technology here in Washington, D.C. On a more personal note about her career path and the way she entered the world of policy and surveillance and privacy and what led her to where she is right now, which is CDT and GW, and how she made the choices she made and fell in love with this area of law?
Yeah, you know, it was not intentional. I was in law school when 9/11 happened, and at the time, I planned to be just a very traditional civil rights lawyer and do race and gender issues, employment and education, and fell into this, you know, the rights analysis of these sorts of programs. So I graduated in 2003 and went to the Hill, to the House Judiciary Committee. And it was just around the time that, you know, habeas petitions were being filed for all of these detainees in Guantanamo and the photos from Abu Ghraib leaked, right? So now there are torture questions. And libertarians and librarians were starting to organize around the Patriot Act. And there was suddenly an interest in national security issues that there hadn't been domestically in a very long time. And at the time, there wasn't a national security center at every law school in the country, right? And so it really felt like we were tackling something new and exciting. And man, here I am 14 years later, still talking about spying and technology. And it's an area that constantly changes. Talk about job security, right? Every time there's a new technology, the government tries to find a way to use it to collect information. So there will always be new challenges. And, you know, even if you're not squarely in the surveillance bucket, there's a lot of cybersecurity work that I think will be more about what the next 10 years are, whereas maybe surveillance was the last 10 years. But cybersecurity is exciting. It's not as partisan. There's still a lot of new ideas. People aren't as entrenched as much. So it feels like there are more opportunities to try new things and make headway.
Thank you so much for sharing your professional journey with us. We're going to be doing more of these Women in Tech Policy Career Paths segments in the future. You can follow Tech Freedom on Facebook and Twitter at Tech Freedom, and also download our show on iTunes and leave us a review. Let me know how I'm doing with my accent. Michelle, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.
Next up, Dr. Betsy Cooper, Executive Director of the Berkeley Center for Long-Term Cybersecurity. You've had, and you are still having, an amazing career, and you've done so many different things across continents. Do you mind telling us a little bit about your journey, how you ended up in law school in the first place, then in the government, and then in the private sector, and then in academia? What were the outliers? What was your inspiration behind it?
Yeah, so my career has been kind of interesting because I certainly didn't start either in tech or in cybersecurity. I was working for many years on homeland security, immigration, countering violent extremism, spent some time in academia doing a doctoral dissertation on those topics. When I came to law school, I really discovered a passion for tech issues. I worked at Yale helping to found the Media Freedom and Information Access Clinic, worked with a great faculty member over there, Jack Balkin.
Hello, Professor Balkin.
Professor Balkin.
This is your second shout out this month.
But so I decided to write a paper, one of my writing requirements actually at Yale. Yes, we have to write stuff, I swear. And it was on Watson, the Jeopardy computer. And I looked at how Watson, and this is back, of course, in 2011. I think Watson has since been used as a buzzword for machine learning systems generally. But at the time, it was focused on Jeopardy. And the article that I wrote focused on how Watson, the Jeopardy computer, could be used to help judges make decisions. I tried to patent this idea, but it didn't quite succeed. So IBM, it's for you. I sort of, when I left law school, figured I'd just go right back to my immigration. You know, I went to clerk. I then ended up trying to go to the department to work on specifically on immigration. And totally by happenstance, my bosses actually left. There was a transition in administration, and the person I was supposed to report to wasn't there anymore. And so I ended up kind of without a job and needed to find something to do. And so I ended up actually taking my tech sort of experience back and working on cybersecurity instead. So it was a very interesting time in which, you know, I was sort of handed a portfolio working on the Quadrennial Homeland Security Review, working on issues of child exploitation on the internet, completely random issues that I never thought I'd be involved with, but was very interested in understanding that intersection between tech and, you know, sort of the vulnerable populations between tech and how we were going to protect ourselves on the internet. And so I really started pulling that into my career from there. And so it was at that intersection that I saw this great opportunity to move over to Berkeley and to help build this institution focused on the future of cybersecurity, to really help understand not just what was happening today, but where we needed to take this system for tomorrow. And so that was what really led me to hop over to Berkeley. Been there for about 2.5 years now, helping to build this center and really trying to find those intersections with the issues that many of us care deeply about, because the internet is not just a place where we play anymore. It's a place where we work. It's the place where actually much of what we do happens. And if we don't figure out how to make that secure, then all those values that we care about won't actually be able to happen anymore. And so it's that issue that I care about really deeply.
KF Gallis is an attorney with a focus on internet issues. And to end the show, I would like to talk a little bit about your career path. So in our little segment called Women in Tech, in this case, Women in Tech Law and Policy, would you mind sharing with our listeners how you ended up doing what you're doing and what led you to be passionate about these issues?
Oh, sure. I think starting in middle school, we'll go all the way back to there. In middle school, I read Linda Ellerbee's book, And So It Goes, and I saw the movie Broadcast News, and I got so interested in mass media. So all through high school, I was the editor-in-chief of the school paper, and then I went off to college, and I was going to be a mass communications major, which I in fact was, but I got to college in the early 90s when information technology was starting to become a thing, and I decided, originally I thought my choices were TV, radio, newspaper, but I'm like, oh, IT. IT just inspired me for the same way that all the other mass media inspired me. It was such a democratically oriented medium, what people could say and how, you know, really putting into fruition what the First Amendment, the promise of the First Amendment was. So I ended up studying that. And when I graduated from college, I was qualified to be a webmaster. And I was living in Silicon Valley in the mid-90s, in the beginning of the boom. It turned out to be a great place to start a career. So I had a career in the internet, which was now a thing. And I had that career up and through, then the boom turned into the bust, and that got a little tricky. But it wasn't that, oh gosh, I have no job anymore. There was a question of, I was aware that policy was changing around information technology. And what I wrote in my law school admissions essay was, people are making the law around technology, and they don't understand how it works or how people use it. And I understand both. So put me in coach. I should be telling people how things work. So I went to law school so I could get a credential that I thought would be easier to wave around so people would have to listen to me. And now I'm here on a podcast as a lawyer. And so I guess it worked. And but that's basically the chain of what got me here. It's a very long lifespan of things that have always interested me. And I feel like I can make a difference to protect the things that had been so fascinating about it.
Jennifer Granick, a surveillance and cybersecurity counsel for ACLU, is up next.
Our new host, Ashkan Kazarian, our legal fellow, has been doing a segment at the end of these interviews called Women in Tech, just asking women we've had on the show about their careers. I think you're probably the dean of women in surveillance law, certainly among the ones we've had on. What's been your experience?
From a perspective of being a woman? You know, I've been, I think, pretty lucky in a lot of ways and very insulated as I read the paper and I see the experiences that women have had in various fields, you know, in Hollywood, in, you know, the hacker world, in tech companies. And I think that I got really lucky. I had a lot of great mentors, most of whom were men as I came up professionally. The work I did in the beginning of my career when I was representing hackers, there wasn't really anybody else who was doing it. I never got any kind of negative feedback or was compared negatively to anybody for being a woman. Maybe because there wasn't any guy to compare me negatively to, but I always had a, you know, I never had a difficult time with that. And I think that, you know, I have had a pretty good run of it.
Carrie Wade is a director of harm reduction policy and senior fellow at the Arstead Institute.
I wanted to ask you, Carrie, to share with our listeners a little bit about your journey to being part of this policy area, and how did you end up in D.C., and what made you want to work on this issue? I mean, you have a PhD, you have a master's, you could have been doing anything.
Well, I think that's an interesting question, so I'll... My background is actually in opioid pharmacology, and I did a lot with pain, chronic pain. And we're looking at biological mechanisms of chronic pain and whether or not opioids can exacerbate or protect, treat chronic pain. And this is in biological systems, so on a very basic level, on a cellular level. From that, I wanted to learn more about addiction, so I did a postdoc at Scripps Research Institute in San Diego. From there, I really thought that having a policy background would be more influential than doing basic science research in the lab. So I did. I went to Johns Hopkins and did a master's in public health. And from there, and my focus there was also on opioid harm reduction. What's interesting about that is throughout this whole time, my background in opioids, it never occurred to me that these lessons that we learn in opioids could be extended to tobacco. And when I started working in D.C., this issue became important to me because of the sheer volume and the sheer volume of smokers that are in this country and the influence that you can have on such an important issue.
Across the, you know, the researchers and academia and the policy, would you say there are a lot of women that work on this issue? Is it 50-50? Is it there a few?
It is definitely not 50-50. No, there's a lot of younger women
who are entering
this area. And I'm really happy to be a part of that generation of people of women who are coming into this area.
And last but not least, we have Tiffany Lee, resident fellow at Yale Law School's Information Society Project, where she leads their Wikimedia Yale Law School initiative on intermediaries and information.
So as we were recording and we said hello to the Russian intelligence officers, our recording device shut down. Now we're back up with Tiffany, who was sharing with us her career path and how she realized that international law is not,
you know, existent in some ways. Sorry, Professor Halfway. but it's also, you know, the tech part of it is very global, you said, right?
Right, definitely. So technology is global in nature. And I think during my first year of law school, I realized that I've always been passionate about technology in some ways. I love science fiction since childhood. When I was 10 years old, I subscribed to Asimov's science fiction magazine, which I think is one of the nerdiest facts about me. So this love of science fiction and thinking about the future was something that I didn't realize could be part of my legal career until I got into law school. And in my first year of law school, I started talking to other attorneys who had done work in this area. And I realized that being a tech lawyer, you could really work on issues that weren't even really set in stone yet. So instead of just negotiating contracts every day or trying to figure out the best litigation strategy for something, you could work specifically on issues that were really exciting to me because they weren't determined. So I'm sure you know this as well, but so many technology law issues, technology law and policy issues are just completely up in the air, changing every day, constantly being renewed and rebooted. And that to me was something fascinating. So during law school, I decided I wanted to do technology law. What technology law was a good question. And that's something that I had to find out through really talking to a lot of people. I think my best advice for law students or people who are just starting out in this field is to talk to as many people as you possibly can. Talk to people, especially people who have done things that you think are interesting that you would want to do, and then ask them how they got there. For example, I talked to many older attorneys who had worked in tech or who were at tech companies or in tech organizations and asked how they became experts and leaders in their field. And I think what really I learned was that you just have to follow your passions. So for me, I realized that my passion was technology. Really, my passion was science fiction, but tech law is the closest thing.
The closest thing, yeah.
It's close enough. So I pursued that passion. I took as many courses as I could that were related to technology and the internet. And I also interned at various tech-related places during law school. And then after law school, I was a privacy fellow at the Wikimedia Foundation, where I had also interned during law school. Love the Wikimedia Foundation. They are the nonprofit that runs Wikipedia and other free knowledge projects. And after that fellowship, I worked as in-house counsel for a technology education company based in New York called General Assembly. They do education, coding, UX design, that kind of thing. So being an in-house counsel, I think, is really great. And it's something that I enjoyed quite a lot. I think the best part of it for anyone thinking about in-house career, the best part about being an in-house counsel is really working with non-lawyers. When I talk to new grads and law students who are thinking about in-house careers, I always put it this way. If you're especially in technology, you run into two scenarios. Either you get that sort of one-man shop that you discussed, right, where you have a very small legal team and they have to do absolutely everything. That involves contracts, litigation, real estate, employment law. If you're an internet company, you have the terms of service, you have the privacy policies, you have trust and safety. All of that is done by a very small team where everyone has to be a team player and do really any area of law they can. That's one scenario. The other scenario is you get into one of those very large companies. For example, if you're an in-house attorney at Google, you will not be doing everything. You will be doing, for example, strictly only open source licensing. And that's when you get into a large enough company where they have, you know, tons of attorneys and every attorney has a very specific role. Now, if you are a new grad or you are an attorney with only a few years of experience and you're trying to get into the tech sector, I think that the best decision or the best choice would be to try to get into a small or mid-sized company. And I'm saying this because if you apply directly, for example, to Google with no tech experience, it's very unlikely that you'll get hired. If you are at a firm where you've done a lot of tech work, for example, if you did 3 years straight of only tech transactions focusing on internet companies, then you have a much better chance. But if you don't have that background, I would recommend seeking out tech companies that may be slightly smaller that will require you, though, to have many skills and to be able to pick things up very quickly.
Thank you for listening. We have linked to profiles of our guests in the show notes so you can learn more about their work. You can follow Tech Freedom on Facebook and Twitter at Tech Freedom, and please leave us a review so others can find the show. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.